Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MBBN. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we take you to Orono and the Collins Center for the Arts for a talk by Paul Mayeski, director of the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. His talk is entitled Climate Change and the Role of Humans. Mayeski is well known for his research on climate change and has conducted research in over 50 areas, including the Arctic and the Tibetan Plateau. His research has a particular focus on the impact of humans on climate change. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. It will be archived on our website, mbbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Kristen Sobolik, Associate Dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at the University of Maine.
Dr. Mayeski is director of the Climate Change Institute here at the University of Maine, which is one of the world's preeminent climate research centers. His career has spanned four decades, including 47 and counting scientific expeditions throughout vast portions of the Antarctic, Arctic, Himalayan, and Tibetan plateaus, South America, and New Zealand. And he has over 300 peer-reviewed publications in the very top scientific journals. Dr. Mayeski is a much sought-after expert on climate issues and has appeared in 60 Minutes, NOVA, NPR, the BBC, and many other venues. He has won the most prestigious awards in his discipline, including the inaugural International Medal for Excellence in Antarctic Research and the Seligman Crystal, the highest recognition in the field of glaciology. In addition, he is the reigning Distinguished Maine Professor at the University of Maine. Dr. Mayeski is also training the next generation of climate scientists and explorers. He has taken more than 300 students to remote areas of the world on research expeditions and has mentored more than 40 graduate students who have gone on in the field. Tonight, he is going to talk about one of the most pressing environmental issues facing the planet today in his presentation on climate change and the role of humans. Please welcome Dr. Paul Mayeski.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chris. It's great to be here and to see so many friends and students out there. I'll be talking today, obviously, about climate change, and climate is something that we can't escape. The climate in this room, we can talk about the climate in this room, is made up of particular temperature, humidity. There are certain gases in the room. There are particles that are floating around in the room, and those all have an impact on the way we'll spend probably the next hour. Similarly, of course, if you go to the outside world in a much, much vaster way, the climate system changes. We have winters, which are obviously cold in this latitude, summers, which are typically not so terribly cold, and every now and then the winters are punctuated by very mild periods and the summers by cold periods. So there can be a tremendous amount of variability in the climate system. And that variability is not just temperature, but it's also precipitation, and it's the content of the atmosphere, which can affect our health, ecosystem health, and also change temperature, as it has recently in the last few decades with the rise of greenhouse gases. So the question is, how fast does climate change? Why does it change? Before humans came on the scene, were we impacted by climate? After all, if the climate were to change over thousands and thousands of years, it really wouldn't matter from generation to generation. And the other big question is, have we had a significant impact on the climate system? And the answer, of course, is yes, but I'll give you more details. And then the question is, what can we do about some of these things? Well, I I've lumped those under opportunities, and I won't go into a lot of detail, but I'll try to give you some things that I think are good abstract ideas and hopeful concepts for the future. I'll be focusing primarily on the last 10 or 11,000 years. And if you look at the map on the left, it's a cartoon version of what North America and Greenland looked like more than about 15,000 years ago. It's covered by vast, massive ice, on average probably several thousand feet thick. And then sometime around 14, 15,000 years ago, until about 8,000 years ago, the system changed dramatically so that we ended up with what's on the right, the extent of ice that we primarily experience today, which is a frozen Arctic Ocean, a large ice sheet in Greenland, and a series of small ice caps. That difference has had a great deal to do with the way we've evolved as humans. On the left-hand side, when humans were around, and they were, they've been around for a long time, we were mostly hunter-gatherers. By the time the ice sheets had decayed and exposed an awful lot of North America, conditions were significantly milder, and it was possible for humans to develop civilizations, to farm, to stay in one place, to fish, and no longer to move around as a consequence of the weather. Well, there are all sorts of things in the natural climate system that impact us. Just a quick list. A volcano could pop off, as it did in Pinatubo in 1992. It would impact the climate for a year or two. We, of course, have storms that can change in intensity. We have a storm coming tomorrow, so everybody's assuming that they won't be going anywhere for a while. Flood, drought, heat waves, severe cold. All those things happen in the natural environment. So we'll find out some of these things actually become intensified, maybe become more frequent under the conditions that we have today. But we're going to primarily focus on the natural climate in the beginning. We wanted to find out how the climate has changed. We have, over the last 100 plus years, two approaches. One is the last few decades, in which there's satellite imagery that's available. It will show us where clouds have moved. You can tell differences in temperature. You can find where snow has fallen, on and on. And that overlaps with an instrumental record that goes back a little bit more than 100 years in the Northern Hemisphere, and much less time in the Southern Hemisphere, and is primarily a record of how the temperature has changed in the past. And it's great to have this record, and most of the computer modeling that's done is based on this last 100 plus years. But if you want to find out what the full range of the climate system is, how fast it could change in the natural system, how hot it might have been in the past, how cold, how wet, how dry, we need to go back in time. And if we don't go back in time and understand what the full dynamic range of the climate system is, it's not going to be possible to come up with good predictions for the future. So, as it turns out, there are several different ways in which you can understand how the climate has changed in the past, but the one that we focus on is probably the most robust, certainly not the only, but the most robust. It has its limitations, but it's the recovery of ice cores. Cylinders of ice that are about 2 inches up to 5 inches in diameter. Some of them we've drilled 3,000 meters in depth. That's about 10,000 feet. Others are much shallower. We've collected them from all over the world. And they provide us with an understanding of changes in temperature, precipitation, chemistry of the atmosphere, all sorts of things that, believe it or not, even for the last 100 years of the instrumental record, we don't necessarily have a very good handle on. So in some cases, ice cores have even told us what's happened in the last 100 years because humans haven't necessarily recorded all of these things. In 1980, after having taken several weeks to climb up to about 20,000 feet in the Himalayas on our second expedition, we were very, very fortunate to find an interesting situation. Turns out that as we looked towards the Tibetan plateau, there was an air mass coming towards me. I could tell from the clouds. And behind me, down on the Indo-Gangetic Plain, there was another air mass that was coming up. And those two air masses, if you were to look at them from this is the shuttle, the bottom of the shuttle, if you were to look at them from a satellite image, you'd see that In 1980, I was observing an air mass coming from the left off the Indo-Gangetic Plain, low elevations, agricultural activity, and to the north, I was observing an air mass that, in fact, was very, very dry, very cold, came from a high elevation on the Tibetan Plateau. It was precipitating snow, and it was the ideal opportunity to see whether or not the chemistry of the snow in these two different air masses would, in fact, differ. So what we were able to do was actually fingerprint air masses. And that's actually been the hallmark of what we've done for the last few decades. We use a whole series of chemical measurements, in some cases 100 different chemical measurements, to be able to tell where the air mass came from, what it went over, and a whole series of things about the environment that it went over. It's not an animation. It's actually a composite of satellite imagery that shows you cloud patterns moving all over the world. And just to drive home this idea that in order to understand the climate system, it's very important to know which direction air masses are traveling, at what time of year, how they might have changed in the past. And we've actually examined these air masses from all over the world by looking at ice cores. The one example I just gave was from Asia. We've collected three ice cores up at about 24,000 feet on Mount Everest in the last few years, and many others in that area. We've worked in Greenland, where we've actually been able to track acid rain coming off North America and find out how it changed over time, demonstrate that it was in fact produced by human activity. We've worked in Alaska, or I should say my colleague Carl Kreutz of the Institute has been working in Alaska, and one of my students, Eric Osterberg, and we've been looking at a variety of things, but one of the things are lead levels that come off China, and we can tell exactly when they began to reduce the use of leaded fuels, plus many other things. We've been working in New Zealand. The glaciers are disappearing here very fast. And we want to find out something about the connections between this portion of the South Pacific and the rest of the world. We've been working all over Antarctica, traveling about 30,000 kilometers over the surface of Antarctica, collecting many, many ice cores. And most recently, we've been working in the Andes. In fact, several of us, and I think some might be in the room, just returned about a month ago from Tupungatito. It's very close to Santiago. This site's at about just a little bit under 19,000 feet, and we'll be going back next year. We did part of our study. We'll be going back next year to drill down through this glacier. So what have we found out? Tons of things. We found out lead levels are 1,000 times higher today than they are in the natural atmosphere. We've found out how the natural climate system operates. We found out that humans have been impacted dramatically by climate and have impacted the climate dramatically. And we found variations in sea ice extent, a whole series of things. One of the most important things, however, that we've discovered is the occurrence of what are called abrupt climate change events. Until the early 1990s, when we discovered this, it was assumed that the climate system operated very, very slowly. And by slowly, I mean hundreds of years, which basically means that if humans emitted greenhouse gases, pollution into the atmosphere, the likelihood is that by the time the climate system responded, it would be hundreds of years from now, perhaps thousands of years from now, under that thinking. As it turns out, the climate system has the capability, both in the natural world, and as I'll show you also in the modern world, of changing very, very abruptly in less than 1 to 2 years, which means that we could experience, and in fact have experienced in some parts of the world, situations in which suddenly the temperature shifts over a year or two and becomes significantly warmer, significantly colder, wetter, drier, and might stay that way, in fact, for decades, if not many centuries. So we want to find out, has this had an effect in the past on civilizations? After all, if you had, for example, a small change in temperature of 1 degree centigrade or a small amount of drying by 20%, would that be enough to impact humans? And how much of that sort of change has been happening today? We also found out that these abrupt climate change events, again, dramatic changes in precipitation, temperature, wind speed, the frequency of storms occurring in less than 1 to 2 years, sustained for decades, if not centuries in some cases, operates in several different ways. And the primary mechanism for us to think about here is that it is equivalent to taking North America and changing it from its summer condition to its winter condition. And what I mean by summer condition, this blue line, is the path of the westerlies. And the westerlies actually separate the large polar air mass from the air masses in the mid-latitudes. And there is the westerly flow, right along the edge. And in the summertime, it retreats back. In the wintertime, as it is basically right now, it moves farther south. It doesn't always have exactly the shape, but in the winter, that polar region of cold air gets smaller, and in the summer, it gets larger, and in the summer, it gets smaller. And the edge of that, the westerlies, also called the jet stream, depending on how high up you are in the atmosphere, shifts back and forth. And one of the things that we know happens during abrupt climate change events is that this system can actually lock in one direction or the other for a significantly longer period of time during the year. Right now in Maine, we have winters that last about 3 months. There were times in the past in Maine when over a year or two, suddenly the system shifted and we had winters that lasted 6 months, 8 months, perhaps even 10 or 11 months, and vice versa in terms of summer. Why is it important that we know where atmospheric circulations are, where the edge of the jet stream or the westerlies is? Because as it turns out, most of the heat that is transported in the atmosphere at latitudes greater than 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south, right up to the poles, so two-thirds of the northern hemisphere, two-thirds of the southern hemisphere, both heat and moisture is transported by the atmosphere. So if you know where air masses are going, you have a very good understanding of how temperatures will change, how precipitation will change, and how storm patterns will change. So let's take that information, this idea that there is might be abrupt climate change events occurring very, very quickly, therefore could have a dramatic impact on civilization, the way our ancestors lived, and see if any of those occurred during major changes in civilization. Now, there's a big caution here. I'm not implying that every single time civilization changes, every single time humans do things, that it's a consequence of climate change. But sometimes it is almost entirely a consequence of climate change, and sometimes it's just enough of a climate change that it puts stress on societies so that, in fact, they can no longer grow crops. And if you can't grow crops and you need food, you might go someplace else to go and find it, and in the process, you might create a war. You might migrate. There are a whole variety of climate stresses, even small, that can lead humans to do things that they might, or civilization to change in ways that it might not always. Does that mean that every single time, again, that civilization changes is because of climate? No. But I'm going to show you examples that we really feel demonstrate the significance of climate change. And the one of the most important things to keep in mind is that these are actually very small changes. Some cases, they're just 1 degree or half a degree centigrade, so close to 1 degree Fahrenheit, very small changes, and yet they lead to the collapse, in some cases, of civilization. So to do that, we're going to look at some records that have come from ice cores, and I'll take you through the records. I'll use just one or two, and I'll explain what we understand from that record. But in order to do that, we'll be tracking air masses. And the first type of air mass that we'll be tracking is sea salt that comes off the ocean. And the stronger the winds, the more sea salt is carried onto either a large ice sheet like Antarctica and Greenland, or maybe onto a mountain glacier in the Andes or the Himalayas. We'll also be looking at dusts in the form of calcium and iron and all sorts of other things that are picked up on the land masses, and the stronger the wind or the drier the conditions, the more of that's picked up, and that's also transported to ice sheets and to mountain glaciers. And then we'll also be looking at volcanic events, Typically, we look at sulfur as a major byproduct and impact on the climate system. And there have been some very, very dramatic volcanic events, and we'll take a look at one that was a showstopper for our society. And then eventually we'll end up looking at a whole series of things, without necessarily going into the details, that have actually changed dramatically in the last 100 years, in which the levels, in fact, are probably unsurpassed in the longest records that we have from ice cores, which is pretty close to 1 million years now. And that's as a consequence of mining activity, industrial activity, agricultural activity, urbanization, and a variety of other things. So first, let's take a look at a very generalized record. This is a record for the North Atlantic, and it tells us something about, tells us something about the jumping back and forth of this westerly system from its milder, more summer-like state to its more winter-like state. This record goes from 12,000 years ago to the present, so it's the time when the ice sheets are in the Northern Hemisphere look the way they do today. And we see that there are a series of very prominent cold and very stormy periods, recognized by the blue arrows there. And in between those are the red periods, times when there are more summer-like conditions, when the general conditions in the North Atlantic are milder and less stormy. And now, let's pick some time periods that we want to look at and some places that we want to look at. And one of the ones that is probably of greatest interest is this entire region of the Middle East right into eastern China, because this region has been the seat of civilization for thousands of years. And in particular, based on this particular map that I found on the web, as of about 4,000 years ago, the orange and the blue areas right in that heart of civilization were basically the only place on Earth, except for this small region here, in which there were relatively complex farming societies, chiefdoms, and state societies. And that was about 4,000 years ago. And they had built up over a series of thousands of years to get to this state. So let's find out, are there any events that were important, have been important over the last few thousand years? And as it turns out, remember that the blue are periods when it's relatively cold and there are intense storms. And as it turns out, it's a region called Mesopotamia in modern-day Syria, a region of tremendous cultural diversity that had sprung up before 8,200 years ago, and at about 80, and it was again, in, it was centered in this general region in here. But about 8,200 years ago, there was a sudden collapse. I'm not an archaeologist; I don't necessarily know how long the effects of this collapse stayed, but the important thing about this collapse is that it is a very unique time in the North Atlantic climate record, number one. And number two, as it turns out, every place we've gone, and many other people who study past climate have gone around the world, you find evidence of this 8,200-year event. So it has been a time period, was a time period of great disruption. In the North Atlantic, at the very least, it was cold and stormy. We also know that in parts of Antarctica, and certainly in Asia, it was also very cold and stormy. Question is, why would this suddenly happen? When it did happen, it happened in just a few years. This cold, stormy period lasted for at least 200 to 400 years, and it was a showstopper for whichever societies were around at that time. And as it turns out, this was, in fact, one of the dominant society or locations of the dominant societies at that time. Around 4,200 years ago is also another very, very dramatic change that occurs, in particular, in Mesopotamia, the region of modern-day Syria. And as it turns out, that event is seen all the way into eastern China. And if you take a look at where 4,200 years is on this plot of cold and stormy versus mild and weak period, it's during a relatively mild period, and if we want to get some more detail about that period, we can blow the record. This is a different record. This is a record that demonstrates the extent of sea ice in the North Atlantic. When there is more sea ice in the North Atlantic, it's more winter-like conditions. When there's less sea ice in the North Atlantic, more summer-like conditions. And this particular record comes from an ice core that we took about five summers, about 20 months to recover. This record goes down 10,000 feet to the bed of the Greenland ice sheet, and we can count year by year back through time. And what we've done is taken one of the measurements and convert it into an understanding of the changes in sea ice. And this dramatic change in culture in what is now modern-day Syria that occurred 4,200 years ago is known to be a drought. The cities were abandoned. It turns out the cities were, as we now realize, very close to regions that are on the edge of the desert. So basically, the desert just expanded into this area. And the one thing that we can't do without, other than air, obviously, is water. And this particular society, despite the fact that it was extremely well-developed, lost access to water. So there's nothing left now today except excavations. And if you take a look at the time period and compare it to North Atlantic sea ice variability, you find out that of the last 10,000 years, except for today, which is actually not on the map, of the last 10,000 years, this was the mildest time with respect to North Atlantic sea ice, which means, therefore, that summer conditions prevailed for a long period of time. The event started very, very fast, definitely less than 10 years. And it turns out when the summers are long, the Middle East, of course, where Mesopotamia and modern-day Syria are, is dry. This is always the dry period because the circulation patterns that feed moisture into the Middle East are conducive to bringing in water only in the winter. When summer conditions prevail, the air masses don't blow off the ocean, and as a consequence, you have drying. Let's move to an even more recent time period in this ancient region of the Middle East. And turns out that based on records, 3,645 years ago, there was a show-stopping event. It was the eruption of a massive volcano. There's an example. It threw into the atmosphere 30 to 40 cubic kilometers of material, much of it in the form of sulfur, which in fact you can see in a record of sulfur from that same ice core that I was talking about before. This record goes from 2,000 to 6,000 years ago. And that material went as high as 40 kilometers into the atmosphere. These are all estimates, of course. There was nobody measuring it. But this is based on the range and the volume of material. So what's the significance of massive amounts of sulfur in the atmosphere? Benjamin Franklin, when he was traveling as the U.S. ambassador to France back and forth to Europe, noticed that the sky was a little bit pinkish looking in eastern North America and western Europe. Turns out there was a volcano that had erupted at that time, and he also realized that the temperatures were colder in eastern North America and western Europe at that time. Sulfur, when it gets into the atmosphere, shields incoming radiation. And in shielding incoming radiation, it reduces the available heat at the surface of the Earth, and in the process, obviously makes it cooler. But in this particular case, it was more than just a lot of sulfur in the atmosphere. There's a tremendous amount of ash that was emitted by what is the most common name, has several names, this volcano, Santorini. And in fact, in some places, there were several meters thickness of ash very, very close to the ejection site. But as you go out, there was easily 10 to 20 centimeters of ash. And that obviously would have had a dramatic impact on agriculture, humans just breathing. So this was a showstopper for this environment. And then in the very same region in the Middle East, both about 800 and 900 years ago, there was another major collapse. And if you take a look at the record of warm and cold, That's during a very, very mild period. And if we take a look at the extent of sea ice, it's again during a very, very warm period in the North Atlantic when there was relatively small amount of sea ice. So if we take a look at what has happened in the Middle East, ancient Mesopotamia as a focus point, we find out that it was impacted by three completely different things, all of which led to major changes and potential collapses in society. One of these was this massive global cooling event that severely impacted that area. It may simply have gotten too cold to grow the sort of crops that they were used to growing. The next was a massive volcanic event, Santorini, that changed the temperature in the region and obviously blanketed the region with tremendous amount of material. And then a massive warming event, I forgot to put the 42 on there, a massive warming event at 4,200 years ago, and then a massive warming event in the North Atlantic 800 and 900 years ago, both of which are related to sea ice extent, and both of which lead to drought in the Middle East. So three very, very different things that impacted collapse in this area. Now let's move up to a more recent time. Let's look at the last 1,000 years, and about 700 to 800 AD, the Norse began to expand dramatically throughout Europe, moving eastward. But by also at about 1,000 AD, during the very, very mild period, remember, very little sea ice in the North Atlantic, they started to make their way at about 900 to 1,000 AD, gradually westward, and eventually colonized both the western side of Greenland and the eastern side of Greenland. And in the process of doing that, they built cathedrals, they grazed sheep just as they had done in Scandinavia, and they maintained an absolutely Scandinavian European lifestyle. As it turns out, AD 1400 was not a good time for them. This is a period of very, very abrupt, in less than a few years, cooling and massive increase in the number of storms, and the net result was that the Norse, and here's that sea ice record to show you very, very extensive sea ice in the North Atlantic. It basically locked the Norse off from the European transport systems, and because they maintained primarily a European as opposed to an Inuit lifestyle, they starved in a very, very short period of time. And it's well known that they starved. They weren't killed by the locals. They simply starved. You can tell by what they ate, by the sorts of insects that were in there. And as a consequence, these amazing cathedrals that they built were left abandoned. So now we have two ends of the spectrum with respect to dramatic changes in the extent of sea ice. And sea ice is going to be expanded under conditions in which, remember, the westerlies move farther south, allowing that large polar air mass to expand and cool off the surface of the ocean. One is an example of very, very little sea ice in the North Atlantic leading to drought in the Middle East, and the other is a massive expansion, very fast expansion of sea ice that leads to the Norse being cut off. And looking at these two examples, we wonder, in fact, what's going to happen today. And this is a simulation done by NOAA. It's making its way up to about 2,000 right now. You can see changes in the extent of sea ice. And we all know, of course, what's happening to Arctic sea ice. It's the very same thing that happened to the people in the Middle East 4,200 years ago, except that the extent of sea ice is probably going to be less than was experienced 4,200 years ago. And I like to show this, although it's very old, the original estimates that came out of NOAA and many scientists who worked on this was that the summer conditions in the Arctic would have minimal ice cover, and there would be an open northwest passage by 2075. Then they revised it back to about 2045, and now the most recent revision of that is that we probably will have an open Arctic Ocean for transport of vessels in the next 10 years. In fact, there are already people who are buying land along the coast of these areas in expectation of ports opening up in the future. Great investment for your children and your grandchildren. So that's this time period of the last couple of thousand years is very important to us because it's actually it's our immediate predecessor in the climate system. And remember that the Norse, about 1,000 years ago, were able to travel easily to Greenland. It was a very mild period. And then abruptly around AD 1400, there's this massive increase in storms, and it is the beginning of what's called Little Ice Age. It starts about AD 1400. It's well known in historical records in Europe. So let's take a look at the Little Ice Age. Little Ice Age starts AD 1400. There's that very mild period in red. And the coldest portion, the stormiest portion of the Little Ice Age is represented by this time period, from about 1400 up to about roughly 1900. And we'll take a look. This particular ice core record, without going into a lot of detail, is one that tells us about the strength and intensity of the westerlies, the same air mass that I've been speaking about the entire time. And the higher up you go on this graph, the more intense the winds, the lower down, the less intense the winds. And as it turns out, the storm intensification starts around 1400, and then you can see that around this time period in the late 1500s, the storms, based on this record, this is dust in the atmosphere coming off the land, it is very, very strong, and I focus in particular on this event, 1588, not only during, it is the beginning of a very long period of extremely stormy, strong westerlies. What happened in 1588? Well, between the 21st and 29th of July in 1588, Spanish Armada sailed on Great Britain. And when they sailed towards Great Britain, they started obviously from Spain. They made their way around the western side of Great Britain. They came down in this direction, and they were hit by what they were inevitably and most likely going to be hit by, very, very strong westerly winds that eventually sank the Spanish Armada. They lost 132 vessels, 5,000 people were lost, and 3,200 cannons. It was, had they been able to attack Britain, we might all very well be speaking Spanish, because at that time the Spaniards were very, very strong. They had, in order to be able to do this, they clearly had a dominant navy, and they had spread themselves out around the entire region. But they picked, unfortunately for them, the wrong time to attack. Had they gone 40 years earlier, the probability is that the storm frequency would have been much, much lower. Now let's take a look at temperature over the last 1,000 years. This is a record that comes from a combination of ice cores, tree rings, lake sediments, a whole bunch of things. And the blue is the actual data. The yellow is actually smooth. It goes from 1,000 years ago right up to the present. And what you see is until about 1900, you don't have a dramatic rise in temperature. But up to about 1400, temperatures are a little bit warmer. And then there again is that little ice age. And the coldest part of the Little Ice Age is roughly 1400 to about 1900. And it is an abrupt change in circulation. It's an abrupt change in temperature, but it's a small change in temperature. It's only about a half a degree, in some places a quarter of a degree centigrade, maximum about a degree centigrade. A very small change. And then after that, we go into the modern era where we have instrumental records, and there's been about a degree centigrade rise in temperature in the last 100 years. Now let's take a look at this transition period. This is the end of the medieval warm period. The Norse, remember, had gone to Greenland in 1000 AD. By 1400 AD, they were frozen in Greenland. The most extensive storms, the coldest period was this time period, and then it begins to warm, and then all of a sudden there's this very, very massive increase in the amount of dust. And that massive increase in the amount of dust is the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, and I would use that as a really good pinning point for talking about the transition between the natural climate system and the human impact on the climate system. At that time, temperatures hadn't risen that much as a consequence of greenhouse gases. In fact, they were most likely still in the overall range of natural variability. But clearly, the storm patterns of the Little Ice Age had become milder. And the reason that this immense dust storm occurred is because they were still, in general, Little Ice Age-like conditions in the early part of the 1900s. But also, agricultural practices were such that the soil was not replenished the right way. And as a consequence, when the winds did pick up, because they were still moderately strong, they picked up all this dust, and basically all of the fertile soil was lost. So it's a good transition period. So why does the climate system change? It changes because of a whole series of things. It changes because of where we are in the solar system, because of changes in greenhouse gases, because of the way the ocean circulates heat, because of the way ice masses get larger to a certain point and then suddenly collapse, because of a whole variety of things, because of changes in the energy output of the sun, and because of dusts that get into the atmosphere, like the Dust Bowl, or volcanic activity ejecting sulfur into the atmosphere. These are all the things that happen in the natural system. Which of these is able to produce abrupt climate change? It turns out that all of them are potential triggers for abrupt climate change, except for this one, which operates very, very slowly, and this one, ice dynamics, changes in the extent of ice, which tends to operate very, very slowly. But changes in solar variability, all of these are able to, in fact, produce abrupt climate change. And we know this because we can actually track changes in solar variability using ice cores. We can track changes in aerosols. We can track changes in greenhouse gases. And we know that they help to build conditions conducive to abrupt climate change. So what's happened today? Is there anything that's different? As it turns out, two of the things which dramatically impact abrupt climate change have increased dramatically. One of these is greenhouse gases. And we know what the greenhouse gases are. They're carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, not listed on here, ozone, which I'll talk about later. There's ozone down to the ground level, which is a pollutant, and ozone higher up. We'll get to that. And then water vapor. And in the case, for example, of just carbon dioxide, without going into a lot of detail, what's happened to make it a really important potential source of abrupt climate change is that for the first time ever, in at least a million years, if not much, much longer, greenhouse gases have risen above their natural levels by about 30 to 40%. But that's not even the most important thing. The most important thing is that they have risen 100 times faster than they ever have in the past. So this means that all of a sudden greenhouse gases are being emitted so fast that they have the capability of trapping heat at the surface of the Earth, and in order for the Earth to release this heat and distribute it around, there is the potential for abrupt climate change. And the other thing which has intensified dramatically in the last century are sulfate aerosols, little particles, not just from volcanic activity, which volcanoes eject whenever they feel like it, but as a consequence of the burning of fossil fuels, and in particular sulfur-dirty fuels, which have now been legislated, and we've done a good job of reducing them. But they also can produce, at least in some regions, abrupt change. Plus, as a consequence of deforestation, agricultural activities, and atmospheric circulation patterns moving, dust levels are changing in the atmosphere. There is no doubt at all that the level of particulates in the atmosphere is higher now than it's been in the past. Part of it's due to urbanization, and it also has a tremendous health hazard. So, if we just look very briefly, even at this is a lot of information, but it's really the cartoons are probably more important. If you look at the last 5,000 years, and I could go out to the last million years, but it would be even harder to see it, and examine what's happened in the last 100 years versus the last 5,000 years, there are things that we have undeniably done to the climate system. We have elevated greenhouse gases, if you can read it. We've introduced new chemicals like chlorofluorocarbons to the atmosphere. We have introduced radioactivity, which we all know about. But actually, we've been using in ice cores the above-ground atomic bomb testing as a time marker in our ice cores. And we actually even discovered the Chernobyl nuclear accident at the South Pole in the Southern Hemisphere. We've been throwing acid rain, both sulfur and nitrate into the atmosphere, which have tremendous impacts, one of these on temperature, the other one on ecosystem and human health. And then we've thrown a whole bunch of really nasty trace elements into the atmosphere at levels which are, in some cases, hundreds, if not a thousand times higher than they are in the natural atmosphere. The most recent one we've discovered is in Antarctica, where in the last 30 years, levels of uranium have increased 1,000 times. So you put all these things together, warming, which creates drought, it can create, in some cases, flood, intensify storms, and it can also lead to vector-borne diseases, because as Maine gets warmer, we all know the ticks have made their, Lyme ticks have made their way north into Maine. Particles are important to humans and ecosystems because they clog up our respiratory system. There is neurological and cancer causing things that we put into the atmosphere. Some of them are humanly engineered chemicals. Some of them are trace elements that we find in the natural atmosphere, like uranium, like cesium, but they're 1,000 times higher than they've ever been before. And we've created tremendous ecosystem upheaval in the form of acidifying the ocean, variety of other things. So, the last 100 years, we have dramatically impacted the climate system. It's no longer as simple as us sitting around and being impacted by an abrupt climate change, which is caused naturally. We're now beginning to complicate the system dramatically and have created what I like to call the toxic climate cocktail. In the next 100 years, the most conservative estimates are a 1 degree centigrade rise. The average estimates are a 3 degree centigrade rise, and the most extremes are a 6 degree centigrade rise. Remember that everything that I talked about in the last 1,000 years all happened within the range of a quarter to about 1 degree centigrade. And now, as a consequence of this 100 times faster than ever and dramatically elevated levels of greenhouse gases, we will experience at the very least 2 to 3 plus degrees centigrade. And so the question is, what's going to happen? And you've heard many, many of these suggestions for the future, but let me talk about the ones that are absolutely going to happen, because we know they've happened in the past. One of these is an estimate of where drought will occur throughout the planet. This is based on sort of an average level of emissions of greenhouse gases over the last 100 years. All of the orange and red spots are places that are expected to get drier. This one we know for sure. Whenever it gets warmer, it gets drier. There's that seed of civilization 4,000 years ago that was hit many times by significant droughts. Without a doubt, we know that sea ice extent is going to decrease, and we know that when it decreases, it changes the distribution of temperature, precipitation around the planet. We know that it has tremendous geopolitical implications because of the access through the Arctic Ocean in the summertime. We know that anybody who came to Sheila Watt Cloutier's presentation knows that the people and the ecosystem in the Arctic are changing dramatically. There is no doubt at all, based on their observations, that the changes are unparalleled in the last few hundred years. And if you look at the past records of climate, they're unparalleled in the last several thousand years at the most conservative level. Oops. And we can expect drought in some parts of the world. This one is in particular estimated that in Western United States there'll be a fourfold increase in drought or has been a fourfold increase in drought in the last 30 years, and the expectation is that this will continue for the future. So, what's going on today? What might explain some of the very odd behavior in the climate system that we've been experiencing and might happen in the near future? Let's go back to abrupt climate change, because if these things happen gradually, we can probably adjust to them. They might happen faster than they did in the natural environment, but if they happen abruptly in a year or two, which is possible, we need to know about it. That's the most extreme case. And if they happen over the next 20 to 30 years, they're still going to be serious. Let's take a look at this model for abrupt climate change, remembering that under conditions in which warming occurs, basically it's as if the polar cell, represented by the edge of the jet stream of the westerlies, snaps back and now is kept in its summer-like condition for a longer period of time. Let's take the Earth and flatten it over. This is the South Pole. That's the North Pole. These are the tropics, obviously a region of warm air. This is the South Polar region with Antarctica, which is one and a half, it's an ice mass, one and a half times the size of the United States, on average about 6,000 feet in thickness. And then this is the Arctic Ocean area. And these are the westerlies. The westerlies, actually, this jet stream goes right up into the atmosphere. And when you're flying high up in the atmosphere and you get into one of these jets, the wind speeds can easily be in excess of 100 miles an hour, which gives you the nice tailwind if you're going in the right direction. So that jet stream is very, very important, and where it rests is very important. We know that it's changed in position over time from some of the things that I talked about, plus many other things that can be demonstrated. So what is the current, how is the current behavior of that jet, of the jet stream of the westerlies, different than it's been in the past? As it turns out, as a consequence of greenhouse gas warming in the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, and also because of the Antarctic ozone hole, some very interesting things have happened. We've had clearly warming throughout the entire mid-latitudes and the tropical regions, and because the Arctic Ocean is melting away and exposing ocean, we've had warming in the ocean in the northern hemisphere. The net result is that it's gotten warmer here and warmer here, and that means that the gradient that actually controls the wind speeds has flattened out, and as a consequence, the westerlies, rotating in this direction, the westerlies have actually weakened in the northern hemisphere relative to the last few hundred years, which basically means that air masses can go back and forth more easily, as opposed to what's happened in the southern hemisphere, where warming is certainly continuing, but as a consequence of the Antarctic ozone hole, without going into a lot of details, the Antarctic ozone hole has actually resulted in a cooling of the Antarctic, because ozone at the high levels of the atmosphere, 15 to 25 kilometers up, actually holds heat above the Antarctic ice sheet. And because we don't have an ozone hole, because we have an ozone hole during portions of the year, the net result is that Antarctica is actually cooling in its interior. Around the edges, it's warming fast, without a doubt. The Antarctic Peninsula is melting very, very quickly. The Southern Ocean is heating up fast. But right over the interior of Antarctica, it is either staying the same or getting a little bit colder. The net result is when you have warm juxtaposed with cold, the winds actually begin to speed up. So as a net result, the westerlies, which are represented by this dark blue area in the southern hemisphere, are actually beginning to contract closer and closer to Antarctica. In the process, they're holding the sea ice closer to Antarctica. And in the process, they're setting up a barrier that's preventing the warming from coming into Antarctica. When this eventually breaks down with greater warming and as the Antarctic ozone hole heals, we'll have a system similar to the northern hemisphere, in which the westerlies are probably weaker. So what's the net result, let's say, in the northern hemisphere? The net result in the northern hemisphere is that no matter what time of year, if these westerlies get weaker, air masses from the south that are generally warm, air masses coming from the north, can go back and forth easily. So we should expect winters that are milder, with some warm air masses penetrating farther north than they have certainly in the last 100 years. And in the summers, we may very well get an occasional incursion of cold air coming down. Unfortunately, greater instability in the climate system. And if we take a look at the oceans are clearly warming, and whenever you warm the oceans, you have more hurricanes. So the net result is, at least for the northern hemisphere, all of the tropics, everything except this portion of Antarctica, we are going to have much less stable climate conditions for the next few decades. And in the case of Antarctica, where air masses, the cold air masses, are actually being blocked and held in by the westerlies, and the warm air masses are blocked away from it, eventually this will collapse, as I mentioned before, and it'll allow warm air masses to come into Antarctica and intensify, perhaps very abruptly, because the westerlies can snap back and forth quickly, allowing significantly more warming. So, if we take a look at the climate system in the last 100 years, there are a lot of reasons why we should pay attention to it. Even in its current state, there are major security issues that we have to be posed with. Amongst these is health. I already talked about human and ecosystem health, ocean acidification, extreme events. Obviously, climate is grading as a consequence of changes in temperature, changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere, and all of the requirements that we have for our heating and cooling, transportation, etc. Tremendous stress on the economy, and the likelihood of intensifying extreme events and having less stable climate is going to increase. So there are a lot of things for us to think about that are going to happen. There are opportunities too. This is the important thing, I believe, is that we understand that we have experienced big changes that are not natural, that some of these are a consequence of what we've done, and that we are in store for even bigger changes. Some of them can be subdued a little bit, others can't. Health is one that actually can be helped quite dramatically. This diagram, without going into a lot of detail, shows you the amount of time that things stay in the atmosphere. Turns out that greenhouse gases like CO2 stay in the atmosphere for 10 to 1,000 years, definitely hundreds of years, which means that the CO2 and the greenhouse methane gas that we've emitted into the atmosphere is something we're going to have to live with for a long time. The likelihood the temperatures will rise 2 to 3 degrees centigrade is, the probability is extremely, extremely high. The best thing we can do, of course, is to reduce our emissions so that we don't go any higher than 2 to 3 degrees. However, some of the things that are really, really hazardous to our health, for example, lower level ozone, which is a pollutant, it impacts respiratory disease. Aerosols, nasty lead, cadmium, mercury, uranium, all of those things stay in the atmosphere for a very short period of time. We had a test of that during 9/11 when the aircraft were no longer allowed to pass over North America. The air cleared up dramatically in a matter of days. So with good legislation, with the knowledge that we are pushing into ever and ever higher levels with respect to some of these aerosols, which are hazardous to our health, it is possible, if we had the right legislation, if we had the ability, it won't happen, obviously, you could clean up the atmosphere and these pollutants in a week. But the ideal, the next best thing would be able to do it over the next few decades. The other great opportunity that we have, particularly in Maine, is, of course, other forms of renewable energy. And this plot is one that I like because it shows you all over the world the distribution of the highest wind speeds. These are wind speeds at about 80 meters above, 240 feet above the Earth's surface, which is where most windmills would be implanted. And as it turns out, this region where we live contains some of the highest wind speeds on the planet. So for a place like Maine, economy and jobs could be dramatically, dramatically changed as a consequence of tapping this remarkable resource. And then, as we begin to think of ways to both to mitigate and adapt and creatively become innovative about the future, it'll open up tons of opportunities for everything from how we conduct the building of our homes to how we drive, and it opens up tremendous new opportunities for jobs, for thinking, for creativity. The next few decades are going to be extremely exciting. We're going to see tremendous efficiency and tremendous cost saving. And let me just show you, as just sort of a parting thing here, what I consider to be a really exciting, innovative thing. And this may seem a little bit strange, but one tends to think that most innovation requires a lot of money. Anything that could, for example, power your house for the entire year must cost a lot of money. And in Maine, people are very creative. And I'm going to show you an example of a situation in, we just came back from South America about a month ago, and we took this video, if I can get the thing to go in the right place here. And so February 8th, we're in the what's called the Colorado River Valley. We're making our way up to 19,000 feet, and this is the part where we drove in. We came across this shack. And the guy has a satellite dish in the middle of nowhere. There's no electricity. There's nothing else. He has actually two flat-screen TVs, and he powers all of it for nothing off an old engine that he simply uses for its weight with an alternator on the side, a little wheel that turns, and he has piping that channels a stream down. It cost him nothing. It's very, very inspirational. We can do things that cost us nothing, too. You can take black pipe and put it on your roof and run your water system through it so that you have solar heated water. You can dig down in the ground in order to get warmer temperatures in the winter and colder temperatures in the summer. None of those digging might cost a lot of money, or if you're very healthy, it might not cost any money. So this is a fellow who has nothing, who lives in one of the remotest parts of Chile, and if he can be innovative, so can we. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MBBN. Today's speaker was Paul Mayeski, director of the University of Maine Climate Change Institute. He recently spoke in Orono at the Collins Center for the Arts. His speech was entitled Climate Change and the Role of Humans. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Paul Mayeski, please call 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to the program again at your convenience by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access the program and many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.